It's Saturday, September 23rd, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today, we'll take your calls and do some geek news.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.org. The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our show, we'll do some geek news and, of course, take your calls. During the second half of the show, when we invite your invite you to join the conversation, here are the numbers, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering its computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and much more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control, Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance, and, of course, Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. We're going to, of course, take people's calls during the second half of the show, but during the first half of the show, let's do Geek News of the Week. And, Sean, I'll start with you, sir.
Hi. Sure.
You start with Sean every week.
I know. Well, Sean's always ready and here on time, so. It's nice.
Rare.
No doubt. Miles, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I was here on time, man. Don't let me in with you.
Oh. Okay, after the venom has cleared the room.
Whoa, okay. I'm jumping in.
Okay, give your stupid news, Sean.
You're right, it's dumb. Let's move on.
Yeah, let's move on. Drew?
No.
Oh, you're not ready, huh?
No.
Okay, oh. Sean.
Sean has good. Now you're skipping me. Oh, that's a nice laugh. Thanks.
I read your news stories. I'm not interested. Okay, Sean.
So a couple of engineers from Warner Brothers filed a patent on an optical disc that holds not only DVD content, but HD DVD and Blu-ray, which are the next generation DVD.
So the current generation and the future generations, whatever they may be, all on one disc?
All on one disc.
Wow, it sounds like a winner.
Yeah, so that sounds perfect.
We'll put a link to the patent up on our site later today.
Okay.
But what's really cool is HD DVD discs embed data at 0.6 millimeter deep pits, while Blu-ray stores data at 0.1 millimeter deep pits. So what this means is with reflective surfaces inside the disc, you can actually have the laser focus on one of those layers.
You can pick which one you want. Yeah. Just like, it's similar to the double density discs that we've saw.
Or double layer.
Double layer discs. So this is compacting all of them all into one.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So
but
it's not a product
movie theaters
yet.
Wanted to, you know, sell a movie, or if, well, you shouldn't say movie theaters, these movie companies who own all of these movies, if they want to sell a high definition version of their movie, like Warner Brothers, I'm sure will want to do at some point, they can actually embed the movie in multiple different formats and ensure that one of those players will...
Right.
But, you know, I'm not sure if it's going to take a special reader to read these discs or if...
It's just a very special writer, I think.
Or if a Blu-ray will actually read the Blu-ray content on this disc.
Well, that would be the reason for the patent, that you could stick it into any drive and it would work.
Well, you know, until you actually get something working.
I think it's
a lot of people file patents, you know, and a lot of great ideas out there. Yesterday, like holographic content, you know, on hard drives. I mean, we just haven't seen it yet.
Yesterday, I was requested by a local gallery that I interact with to help with this installation of a high-definition TV. And they're like, and I said, well, how are you feeding this thing? Where's the computer? And he's like, well, no, we're getting a DVD player. I was like, well, it won't. And so I was trying to explain to them that there isn't actually content that you can buy that you can stick in a DVD player that will produce the high-quality image. And so then I was, you know, debating this and talking to you about it, and it sure is frustrating because that's what's happening is I'm getting confused to what's out there and what's available. And we still haven't seen the manifestation, but I guess they're being released now.
Yeah, and to muddy the waters even further, I've seen some codecs with DivX, so some DivX codecs for high definition that allows a full two-hour movie to
on the
fit
normal
into a single DVD space.
So you're saying it's basically the better compression, you can fit it on the normal technology. You don't have to go to a new type of medium.
Right, but you would need a custom PC. But then we had that story a few weeks ago talking about media PCs taking over.
But there's also this whole issue that the DivX codec can be put in the hardware. It can be put into a DVD player. We've seen the logos on products before. So
DivX in the hardware was a different animal, though, than
I know,
what it is today.
I know, but you could theoretically
you
keep extending it.
You might see doing that, but you're not going to see copyrighted, you know, content
thrown into that.
You know, these movies put into a DivX format. They're more worried about digital rights management, hardware-based digital rights management. Something unlike DVD with the DCESS, which is the content security. What's CSS? Miles, you're our
CSS?
Content style sheets?
No, it's the DVD encryption scheme, which I've completely forgotten the acronym.
So that
was, feels so horrible.
Remember 6 years ago when we started the show, Miles memorized, remembered everything, all acronyms.
Everything. That's why I just asked
Miles.
Slowly
gotten old.
We don't even have to memorize them. Just
no,
Miles.
We just ask.
So
old and busted.
That was cracked, and it's called DCSS. And,
right.
You know, DVDs can now be played anywhere. I mean, the copy
and you
protection.
You can copy them. And,
yeah. I mean, most software has the breaking of CSS built into it so that you can rip DVDs.
And the movie industry doesn't like that?
They don't like
it. The Norwegian hacker kids have been in jail now.
Right.
So the next generation DVD format uses HD copy protection, HDCP, and it's all hardware-based. So the only way to get in the middle of that encrypted stream of data is to put a physical piece of hardware on the electrical lines that decrypt it. And every key is different. It's not going to be easy to do.
Yeah, and Drew, DVD John is not in jail.
He was.
He was arrested, and so they are with a question by the police, but what he did was not illegal by Swedish law.
Sweet.
Well, so I had the country wrong, too.
It's okay.
Well, I like the guy because he cracked him twice.
It's funny that you bring this up because I work with a guy who he's from Sweden. We just hired him. He's an MBA student from Harvard. And he was trying to get a computer to work, and he was having these issues. And it's just one of those things. You have to know the quirks, and I helped him with it.
Sure.
And he's like, well, why does it work with you and it doesn't with me? I said, well, that's the price of neutrality. Oh, Harvard doesn't work around
this. Oh, that's cool. Okay. Thank you very much, Sean. Drew, what's going on with art in San Jose?
Art in San Jose, the San Jose Semaphore. I don't know if you guys have heard about this yet, but a buddy of mine works at Adobe, and so he lives downtown, and he walks through the building every day in San Jose, the big tower complex downtown. They've put in place something called the San Jose Semaphore, which is an artistic installation sponsored by Adobe, and it's broadcasting a secret code from the top of the Adobe building from 7 p.m. to 2 a.m. every night. You can go on their website, sanjosesemaphore.org, and you can actually have a simulcast happening right there, so you can see exactly what's happening while it's going on.
And from what I understand, you can tune in to an FM frequency
when you're there locally,
in a couple block radius,
yeah,
and listen to music that's
it's not
encoded
music.
Messages.
Yeah, it's the code is extremely complex, and so naturally, in an area like San Jose, there's all these people trying to crack it. So the semaphore is a series of spinning discs that are changing shape. They have a bar across them, so there's three or four different positions that the bar can rest in. There's four discs. They're broadcasting simultaneously as they turn the discs and create different patterns, series of numbers and codes from number stations around the world, and also a vocalist that's going along with this. So it's extremely complex. And there's a little bit of music in the background.
And there's a challenge. There's basically a challenge saying you hit first person that cracks it, get creds on the website. You don't actually make any money or anything, but you definitely get to...
It's just an interesting challenge, but
I think it's attractive.
Exactly. I think it's very pretty for the center of downtown.
And, you know, you guys are always asking the kind of stuff I do up at UCSC.
Uh-huh.
I support an arts program that does this kind of work. So this is Digital Art New Media, like the program.
So if this were happening at UCSC, you'd be the person on the top of the Adobe building installing this.
At least making the phone calls. All right.
Thinking it all work.
So check out sanjosesemaphore.org. And it's hard to describe over the air. It really clicks when you see it.
All right. Miles. Hi. Thank you, Drew.
You bet.
Hi. Okay. Has everyone here heard about Patch Tuesday? This is the second Tuesday of every month that Microsoft releases their security patches. They started doing this on a regular basis. But their idea was they'll release it on the second Tuesday of every month and then nothing. And then they release all of them again in a big bulk, presumably tested.
Which makes sense. You got a whole design team, whole development team that needs to be working on patches. You want to get them in a cycle that's a regular thing.
Right. Okay. However, the problem that's arisen from this is that with Patch Tuesday comes Exploit Wednesday. A lot of exploits. Basically, someone will make an exploit for Windows or some Microsoft product, for example, and they'll wait for Patch Tuesday. And after Patch Tuesday and Microsoft releases their patch, then they release their exploit.
And then they got 2 weeks.
No, then they have a month.
A month. Oh, I see what you're saying.
And this was an issue with the Windows Metafile attack that occurred a couple of months ago, where it was a remote exploit of a Windows machine.
Did this have a scary name? Like the love bug or something like that?
People normally remember. No, I think it was actually called the WMF attacks. The
WMF.
Windows Metafile.
All right.
And so a group decided to take matters into their own hands and not wait for Microsoft and reverse engineered a patch for Microsoft themselves and then distributed it around the net. And a lot of administrators actually applied it. This had been done in the past, but administrators at large didn't apply it because it wasn't an official Microsoft patch. It might break things.
Right.
But when this organization did this, or this group of programmers did this, because Microsoft did not respond to the WMF attack for so long and they were left wide open, administrators started applying these third-party patches that weren't sanctioned.
Interesting.
So now what's happened is because of these Exploit Wednesdays that are coming out, we have a group that are being named the Zero-Day Emergency Response Team releasing patches now for Microsoft products, and they're getting more and more legitimacy.
It's brilliant. Microsoft doesn't have to work anymore, and the product gets better.
But a downside to this is that this group could give a patch, and then...
Yeah, Microsoft doesn't apply the code to their code base.
No, not that. But Microsoft gives their fix on Patch Tuesday, and it breaks.
Right.
In other words, the third-party patch plus the Microsoft patch will break Windows or break
some functionality.
There's
definitely a problem there. Right, and that's why Microsoft why Microsoft would say don't apply third-party patches because then you can't rely upon our patches being stable.
Exactly.
That's a major problem.
But if you don't apply the patches, then you're left open for a month.
What could possibly be the solution to this? Maybe running, I don't know, Linux? Okay, thank you very much, Miles, for that. Sean, I'm going to go off to you.
I'm sure major corporations are going to just change what they're doing based on that piece of advice.
That's not very useful for the most
part. I'm not saying it's useful. I'm not going to solve the Microsoft vulnerability problem like that. I mean, I have it solved in my house. I don't put reliable stuff on Windows. I just use it in my workstation.
We could all just not use software at all.
Yeah,
looks nice today.
Yeah.
A note from Alex, a common thing that's done is to uninstall a third-party patch and then install the Microsoft patch. But he was also making the comment of, why doesn't Microsoft just license the third-party patches?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. And apply it to their code base and work from there. The work's done, right?
All right. Mr. Cleveland?
So, speaking of Microsoft, Windows Vista.
I've heard about that.
Yes, is going to come on a single DVD, all flavors of Windows Vista.
The new operating system.
Yeah.
How does that work, Sean? Have they taken stuff out?
Yeah, you know, they haven't been very clear about this, but this has come out in the past week that, you know, there's going to be 6 or 7 flavors of Windows Vista. Starter Edition, Home Basic Edition, Home Premium, Professional, Small Business, Enterprise, Ultimate. And it's some form of those various flavors.
And we kind of have that. We have some of those versions right now. We've got XP Professional. We've XP for like the home. And we have Media Edition.
Yeah, but those come on different discs.
That's right. So this is all on one disc.
If you wanted to upgrade Professional, you'd have to track down a Professional version.
Why are they doing this, releasing it all in one DVD?
Well, it's a lot easier that way. But the big story here is once you're in Windows Vista and you want to upgrade, you could do it on the fly. You just take your disk, your Windows Vista disk, pop it in your computer, You know, probably do some sort of credit card payment, mm-hmm. and you will then be able to upgrade from Home Edition to Ultimate.
I think, you know, we were talking about this before the show, and you said, you know, is it multiple actually images of the OS? I think that you wouldn't be able to do
that. I think it's just one big thing, and I think there's something smart going on.
I think they've designed Vista well enough. Definitely, don't you think? Don't you think it's like that?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I just don't know what to think. But you know what? I'm working to get a Microsoft representative on the show.
To talk about this.
An expert on Vista to talk about some of the cool things coming out from them.
That's the thing. The reason why Vista's taken so long, we have a lot of flack, Microsoft a lot of flack, is that they did a major design. A major design of the OS, right?
Everything is
And when you do that kind of thing, you want to reuse the code you've used. So it makes sense that the pro version is just more features turned on.
Right.
Miles, you got any feedback on this?
Nope.
Drew?
Nope.
Okay. Next
I know that we work with software partners who have enterprise software packages that they'll deliver in a small package, and then you can add license keys and unlock continuing future features.
Makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. That way the scalability is much easier. You don't have to uninstall,
reinstall. I just hope the upgrades aren't too expensive. I mean, it'd be really cool to just upgrade really quickly to something more powerful.
Miles, what's up with net neutrality?
See, that was totally not the story I was going to do.
Man, I'm just guessing here. It's next on the page. What are you doing? The world's coming to an end one? You want to do that one?
No, I was actually going to do the tracking users by the browser cache.
Okay, yeah, that's a good one.
A lot of people out there will, for example, delete all of their cookies or only set up cookies to be a session cookie for their browser. However, there is another method of tracking a user, and that is using the browser cache itself. This is very clever, by the way. Yeah, a browser cache is a local copy of pieces of a website so that when you're trying to load up another page, because there's so many images and the like that are common between one page to the next, that you don't need to make all of that network access. It makes your web browsing faster.
Right.
So in general, a browser cache is a very good thing. However, there was an exploit that I saw in a news story that was, I have to say, ingenious.
It's not exploit. It's, well, I guess, okay.
You're exploiting it. It's just for a purpose that it wasn't meant for. But it can be used for beneficial and malicious
uses. Describe how people use this to track it, users.
And do it
in 15 words or less.
Right.
I'll do it. I love doing this.
Go for it.
All right. So your web browser, when it loads a web page, requests all the things on that page, all the images, different external files, and it gets a local copy of those. And then it goes to the next page, and it requests all the things it doesn't have. So if the back-end server says, well, I have a person requesting this new page, and I never told them about, I only told five people about this one file, and this guy's not taking that file, that means that was one of the people that visited on the first page. That's generally how it's done. More complex than that.
There's one way of doing it. Because I'm already lost, by the way. That's actually not the best way to do it. One of them was just a CSS hack. It was the visited keyword, so that a link that you clicked on looks different or displayed differently than one that you haven't clicked on.
Clever.
And so it will put in a list of items for, say, example, Amazon.com. And if you visited Amazon.com, it will load a background image to that link from your server saying, like, here's an Amazon.com. If you haven't, then you haven't been to Amazon.com. And you can see that very simply.
That's a lot of information you could collect.
Right. And people are using this for phishing attacks.
Yeah.
Because they will, I'm sure everyone has seen the email that has something from Citibank.
Mm-hmm.
But many of us aren't Citibank customers. So we see that and say, Citibank, I'm not a Citibank customer. Yeah, that's obviously a phishing scam. But if you see something from PayPal and you have a PayPal account, you're much more likely to be taken in by this. So what this exploit can do is, even without cookies, even if you have cookies turned off, can still find out whether you go to a certain set of sites and then target the phishing attacks.
I want to put up a page on GeekSpeak for this that says, you know, what sites you've been to. It'd be very easy to do this kind of thing and show people that you know which sites people go to.
Now, if you're using Internet Explorer, well, you're kind of screwed. However, if you are using Firefox, there is an extension called the Clear Private Data. And what that will do is it will clear cookies and the cache at the same time.
I don't think it's an extension. That's just a standard thing you can have it do.
No, it's actually an extension so that you set it up so that every single time you close Firefox, it gets rid of all that data. So when you start up, you're completely blank
clean.
Slate.
All right. Thank you very much, Miles. I'm going to go on to Drew, your last story, Drew.
Interesting new project has come out on the Boink network. It's called Spinhenge.
What is the Boink network? Quickly.
The Boink network is the Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing. It's a way of donating your personal processing power to major world-changing scientific endeavors.
Okay.
And adding up to multiple teraflops of computing power. They've just passed. One guy is now producing 2 teraflops. It's pretty crazy.
Wow.
With a bunch of computers. So you download the software, it runs in the background, crunches numbers, donates it to science.
So Drew, how many flops are you doing?
You know, I've taken my Boink computing cluster apart, Miles. All those beat up old machines that were crunching numbers are just gone now.
What's this new?
But it does bring up an interesting point to folks out there that don't know what a flop is: floating point operation per second.
Good. I still don't know what a flop is. Okay,
it's a measure of computing power, and so 2 teraflops is a giant, giant amount. I mean, it's more than like most single computers will ever get to. Right. I think. I don't know what the biggest one is. Right.
Floating point means like 3.5, 4.7. Those are floating. The decimal point, it will shift around.
Okay.
It's a lot of power.
All right.
So they have this new one called Spinhenge at home, and it's very strange. It's a German research project, and the website's been run through, I'm guessing, a Babelfish translator or something, so it's hard to understand what this is. But it's essentially calculations on molecules and their magnetic ability so that you can create a tiny molecular magnetic switch which goes from 0 to 1. Or
so it's nanotech.
It's nanotech, yep. Molecular magnets controlled nanoscale magnetism. Now, let me just read you a sample
of
what this
ahead.
Site is. By means of these magnetic molecules, new nanomagnetic applications as highly integrated memory modules or tiny magnetic switches will be developed in the future. Let's see, here's a good sentence. In the context of this project, in cooperation with the universities Onnesbruck and Bielefeld and the Ames Laboratory in Ames, Iowa, USA, extensive numeric simulations concerning the physical characteristics of magnetic molecules are processed.
I'm strangely attracted to that project. Thank you very much, Drew.
It's weird, but it's fun.
We're going to do one more story, unfortunately, today. Well, maybe we'll do another one after we invite calls. And I'd like it to be the story on
Hacktivismo.
Hacktivismo. Please explain.
Hacktivismo. International group of security experts and human rights workers who just released Tor Park. Tor Park is an anonymous, fully portable web browser based on Firefox that comes pre-configured, requires no installation, can run on a USB memory stick, and leaves no tracks behind as to your web surfing.
That's a large statement. No tracks.
For free.
Okay. So it's a Firefox version of a browser. You put on a memory stick. You plug it into
any
portable media.
You can even use it on your desktop.
You plug it into a computer, and it saves everything on that, only that memory stick, and also erases stuff as it goes, I'm sure. And then the other thing, though, that it's actually teaming up with this Hacktivismo is it connects to some network that then obscures where you're coming from.
Yeah, it uses the Onion Router network to anonymize the connection between the user and the website that is being visited.
So I can go visit Amazon.com and no one knows I've done that?
Typically, you're assigned an IP address that, anybody, data thieves, governments, hostile governments, they say, can pinpoint the user's identity and location from. What Tor Park does is it uses a bunch of websites all over the world that are part of their network, and it anonymizes those.
So now, instead of me going directly to Amazon to get something, I'd go to one of these servers. The server then goes for me, returns the data, and erases the log information.
You could be surfing from a computer in Santa Cruz,
but
it would appear as if you're surfing from Germany. And then maybe a couple of minutes later, now you're surfing from Russia.
Okay. And it would be good, for example, for people that are in a government regime that doesn't want them to learn about
So your connections and your data is encrypted, but you got to understand it's only encrypted from the Tor Park server
to you,
and not from the Tor Park server to the website.
Right.
So if you were logging into your Yahoo Mail, let's say, you'd still want to use the encrypted connection.
Sure.
But the idea is you could put this Tor Park browser on a USB stick. You go to a local cafe.
And
you can
safe.
Get on anybody's computer, any computer, plug it in. If they let you, and run this browser, and you can surf, anonymously.
I like it. I mean, I like the idea of being more portable without having to bring your laptop around. But the thing that concerns me about it is that it seems like a perfect thing for crime. I mean, you're making yourself completely untrackable, and that seems a little.
Yeah,
that's the fear of a free society.
Well, except for the fact that we won't be able to see where that user is navigating to. You can tell that they're using those anonymizing
the services. ISP mm-hmm. will be able to tell that something's going on here.
Right. So that's one area where a repressive regime would be able to cut you off because
but it's a sticky line between security and civil liberties, you know.
GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. KUSP. Of course, if you'd like to contact us through the web, you're welcome to do so by going to geekspeak.org. Click on Contact Us. Again, that's geekspeak.org. Today, the geeks are Drew Meyer, Miles Elam, and Sean Cleveland. My name is Lyle Troxell. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Geeks, thank you very much for doing such wonderful news this week. And Drew.
KUSP co-sponsors the 13th Annual Monterey Bay Memory Walk. The Alzheimer's Association, the world leader in Alzheimer's research and support, is advancing progress in prevention and cure and living with Alzheimer's. Come join the fun and register yourself, your family, and your friends to participate in the 1 mile or 4 mile memory walk at Seascape Resort and Park in Aptos on Saturday, September 30th. For more information, please call 464-9982.
Thank you, Drew Meyer. I appreciate that. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruise Isle Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruise Isle has rentals, retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. Please join our conversation right now. The numbers are 476-2800. 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Of course, you can go to our website, geekspeak.org, and click on Contact Us to ask us information. And while we're waiting for calls, well, we don't have to wait for calls to come in, but the phone, there are phone lines still available, so if you'd like to call in, please do. 476-2800. From Pebble Beach, Mike, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Mike. What's your question for today?
I'm shopping for a new laptop, and I've been intrigued by the Macintosh dual core. And I have a couple questions there. I'm wondering, first of all, do you think the dual core could be set up to run Vista when it comes out?
I think that the newest Macintosh laptop could run Vista when it comes out, yes.
Ah, and I've heard that there's a the Intel chip isn't working too well, the G5 or something like that. Is that something I need to be worried about?
I haven't heard anything bad about the Intel chip. The one thing that's problematic with Mac,
well,
Apple moving to the Intel is that some of the old software doesn't run as cleanly on the new stuff. Do you have more information about that?
Well, the only thing I heard is in a class I've been taking, they said they get a they didn't explain it, but they just said, well, we've got a G5 flashing on our screen, and that's a problem, and something to do with the Intel chip. They got to get the screen to stop flashing G5, whatever that means.
Yeah, that seems unusual because a G5 is not an Intel chip.
Yeah, that seems a little confusing. But no, I would go with right now that if you're going to be buying a Mac, definitely look for an Intel processor, especially if you're interested in later running Vista.
Yeah.
If you're trying to save money, Core Duo is the way to go. But if you want the latest cutting edge, you want to get the Core 2 Duo, which is the next generation of that chip.
Oh, Core 2 Duo.
Yes.
And is that available on the Macintosh platform?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
You know what? Maybe not notebook yet. Only the iMac.
Yeah, it's not available in the notebooks yet.
I would expect it to be by the end of the year.
You might want to wait a little bit to get it. But then again, how are you planning on running? I mean, out of curiosity, are you planning on running Vista?
Well, I suppose. One of the things I don't want to give up is the ability to access my old Windows software.
Okay. Then you might not want to get a Macintosh computer. I mean, if that's a primary focus for you. I'm nervous about people going, oh, now I can buy a Mac and run Windows and I'll have everything in the world.
Yeah, just keep in mind, they don't sell it to you set up to do that.
Right, you've got
to
do it yourself.
There's going to be some work involved.
And you got to kind of get geeky to do it. And the other thing is that, why do you want the laptop to do everything possible under the sun?
Well, I just want to buy one laptop. But
yeah, I get that. I get that.
And
well, it's definitely possible to do, and people are doing it. It's not completely simple right now.
If Vista comes out and the laptops don't support it, for example, or the Macs don't support it, someone will find a way to get
it'll
it
work
on there.
It'll
happen.
If you're not going to use the Macintosh portion of the notebook, then I would say don't do it.
Yeah, don't buy a Mac if you're not going to use a Mac.
Well, I plan to do that, use the Mac portion, but I tell you one thing that I hate to give up. I have a XL7 installed now.
Uh-huh.
In the computer that I have. And there are some programs, I forget the term, but the
macros?
Yeah, the macros. Does Does Excel in Mac know the difference between a macro written PC?
A macro inside an Excel sheet will work on anything that runs Excel.
Uh-huh.
Unless it's using some weird VB script that, yeah, no, but I believe that you're going to be okay. What you can do is just to have, take that Excel file that you've got a special macro in and find somebody that has a Mac and say, open it and see if it works.
Oh.
And that's the best thing to do. Just send that file to them and then hopefully they won't.
The reason is I have a long history of stocks and mutual funds.
Yeah, definitely test it out before you try it. Get somebody to help you out with a Macintosh and see what it's like. You could even put those Excel files on like a memory stick and bring them to wherever you're taking this class and try it on those computers.
Uh-huh.
It shouldn't be a problem. I wouldn't mind doing that, and I support computers. So thank you very much, Mike, for the call. Good luck with your
purchase. Any problems with the batteries?
At this point, no. You're safe to buy a new computer.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And from Watsonville, Gene, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi, Gene.
This is about what you were talking about with them doing the fishing and being able to see where you've gone.
Yeah.
I guess I'm confused now because I thought the whole reason you did things like firewalls and virus protection was so that people couldn't see what you were doing. And
it's to some degree. Most of the time when we talk about firewalls and virus protection, we're talking about people running code on your computer, restricting them from doing that. But there's other stuff people can do that's pretty clever. We have pretty complicated computer systems, and we do pretty complicated stuff. So the thing that we're talking about right now is if you go to a website, let's say you go to geekspeak.org, and on geekspeak.org, I set up a style sheet, like a code on there that says, that tells your browser to request an image, but only request that image if your browser remembers that it's been to Amazon. So now what's going to happen is an image will show up. You might not even notice this is happening. And now I can look at my logs and go, oh, that person that's visiting right now, whoever that is, actually has already visited Amazon or has not visited Amazon. And that's what they can determine with this scheme. Now, that doesn't seem like a very dangerous thing, but it is to some degree concerning, because if I have a scheme in which I want to steal your money and I know you have visited Amazon, I can assume that you're an Amazon customer. And now I can do things like show the page that looks like Amazon and talk to you as if you're a customer and might fool you into giving me your private information.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it's about. It's about the added benefit of being able to know more about the person that's there and therefore be able to target a scheme against them better. Do you get that?
Yeah.
So as long as you're very smart and savvy, you won't be fooled.
Okay, now with Safari, can you, like what you said, that with Firefox, there's a way of clearing it?
Yes, Safari does have a clear cache, and I'm looking it up right now.
So when do you clear cache? Like every time after you go someplace?
I would, you could do it on, I guess on when you start the machine, start it or close it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, how
often.
It's kind
of useful. I mean, I use the cache all the time.
I love it.
So, and how paranoid do you want to be? How much transaction
and how fast is your internet connection? If you're on dial-up, it becomes harder to deal with. If you're on broadband, clearing the cache, not that big of a deal.
I don't know if I really worry about people knowing that I went to Amazon.com.
Yeah.
I mean, who cares? But that's just me.
But that's all they find out is where you've been.
If they have software that can look at the cache, yes.
Well, no, they don't look at the cache. They just know that you have been there or not, depending on how you access their page.
No, right. Amazon knows that, but she's talking about hackers, right?
We're talking about anybody.
That's
what we're talking about.
Amazon or hackers.
Yeah. Right, so if you give up that information, are you worse off?
Well, to some degree, because they know a little bit more about you and therefore can target you better. I know, it's a difficult one. I'm trying to find the actual...
Yeah. Again, we could unplug them all from the wall and close all the windows and lock the doors.
I know people who won't use computers, yes.
I can't find the clear cache thing in Safari.
Oh, clear cache? It's easy.
Safari.
Yeah, you go to the Safari menu item, and you go to empty cache.
Ah.
So
it's not even a preference.
Are you saying that the cache is also serves some useful purposes?
Oh, it's
and
very
so
useful.
That you don't want to clear it like after every single thing you do.
Absolutely.
It's a convenience for you so that you don't have to figure out where you went before so you can go back there again. And this contains things that are useful when you visit those sites again.
The biggest thing that it does, the thing that's the most useful, is caching the images and background information of the site. So let's say you go to google.com, which is the search engine I use. And the first thing that when your browser is nice and fresh, the first thing it's going to ask for from that page is the Google logo. And then you're going to do a search. And the next page, it's going to show the Google logo. If you don't have a cache, you'll have to ask the server to give it to you again.
Yeah.
So every single page that you visit on Google, you'd have to ask for that same image over and over again. And so the cache says, you've asked for it once. It's good for however long it's good for. I'm not going to even ask for it again. And so the thing is, lots of times the server will say, keep that Google image forever. Now, Google actually probably does it daily because they change it all the time. But
for holidays, I wonder what their cost is to update their Google logo.
Because they're turning off the cache for it.
The amount of download they have.
So the idea here is that you're going to go a lot faster if you have cache on. That's it. And what we're basically saying is you can basically erase your cache anytime you want. It's just that page is going to be a little slower. But the other thing that cache is really good for, other than speed, is other features it has, like saving passwords. But that's not exactly cache, that's passwords. So you should be able to erase your cache without erasing your passwords. And I think we should go on because...
Okay.
Yeah, so thank you so much for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Gene. We're taking calls with questions and comments of technology. We can answer anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. I'm going to do that again nice and slow. 476-2800. 1-800-655-5877. We're going to go to Salinas. Ray, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I consider you guys kind of a wonderful extension of Dr. Dom.
Thank you very much. That's a high honor. Dr. Don Show,
of course. We're the cybernetic additions to the medical show.
Anyway.
Anyway.
I'm a mature guy, so I don't, I've been doing computers a long time, but at some point your brain just loses the ability to recess a whole bunch of new stuff. And I'm having some problems with my browsers. I run both Firefox and Internet Explorer. And sometimes the thing will come up and say, oh, we're sorry, but we just encountered a big problem. We've got to shut down. And I'm like, well, why? And that usually happens with Firefox, so I run both of them so that I'm trying to run a screen that will show me some stuff for stocks, mm-hmm. like a stock chart. And this one program says, are you going to run the stock? You click on it, and it never fails. Firefox says, no, I can't do that. I got to shut down.
Sure.
And then I come back, and I run it on Internet Explorer, and it runs. Any ideas?
Are you running the latest version of Firefox?
Oh, God. How do I know that?
In Firefox, you can check for updates under Help, I believe.
Yeah, in the Help.
I updated it within the last couple of months.
Yeah.
And go to Help and click on Check for Updates.
Okay, go to Help, check on Updates.
And if you don't see that, then you really need to upgrade Firefox.
The newer versions of Firefox have an automatic update feature.
Okay.
I think the answer is even more complex, unfortunately.
Oh, sure.
The stock refresh stuff that's going on is probably in JavaScript, maybe even Java, maybe Flash. And there's some code running inside the browser. And that code is probably tested very well in Internet Explorer. And so that, because most people use Internet Explorer, so the company that produces it makes sure that it doesn't crash in Internet Explorer as well. And they don't spend as much time making sure Firefox doesn't crash.
Oh.
Also, Firefox has a very, we just talked about it, cache, a very aggressive cache, which saves a lot of information. And when you're dealing with uploading, when you're dealing with sending a lot of data back and forth to the browser, which is what those stock tickers are, it's possible that your browser just is exploding in amount of cache it's using, amount of memory it's using, actually. And it's having problems in that regard. And that's kind of an earlier flaw with Firefox. I think they're kind of fixing at this point. Miles, the, quote, memory leak for Firefox, is that addressed or is it still kind of an issue?
It's still an issue.
And this could be a situation where he's running into that problem because his ticker just sits there and collects data all the time.
I don't know. In terms of it just crashing like that, it depends. How much RAM do you have in your system?
That's a good question.
You click on the desk. Go to the desktop and click.
Well,
on
I mean,
computer.
I got the machine right in front of me. It says what I had started out with. Like, gosh, it's a Sony Vaio.
Yeah, that won't tell us. You'd have to go to your desktop and see the picture of my computer. Right-click on that. Choose Properties. And does that screen show memory?
Yep.
Okay. In any case, Miles, how much memory should he have to not have his browser crash all the time?
Well, there's no hard and fast number. It depends on what you're using.
You want a feeling, huh?
Well, I want to find out if he's running with 32 megs of RAM.
Back to my desktop. I'm at the desktop now.
It should be a picture of a thing that says my computer. Choose that. And right-click on that and choose properties. So, Miles, what do you mean it's a feeling about how much memory?
Well, if he says, well, I'm running 64 megs of RAM, I'm going to say...
Kick your computer out the door.
Wow, that's a small amount of RAM. And would probably suggest using Opera, which has a lower memory requirement than the other browsers.
But it's also possible that people are doing stuff that's... Internet Explorer specific sometimes, and you just won't be able to run a different browser. And that's true too, right?
If they require ActiveX controls, it's true.
Yeah.
If it's just them looking for a browser string, which is the most common thing, someone just says, I want to have Internet Explorer, but they don't actually do anything that's Internet Explorer specific.
Yeah.
Then Opera, both Opera and Firefox can be made to pretend that they're Internet Explorer.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. Miles Elam, Drew Meyer, and Sean Cleveland are all in the house. We're talking to Ray from Salinas. Ray, so...
should I just bail out on this thing and get a new machine? The machine's about 5 years old.
How much memory do you have?
Get me back to that again real quick.
Oh, okay.
I got the desktop. I push the start button, then it goes to my computer.
No, not to the start button. On the desktop, there should be an icon of the thing that says my computer.
So
right-click on that icon and say properties.
So I guess you have 20 or 30 icons in your desktop right now.
No,
you
can
go to start, and then my computer will show up in the list. If you right-click on that, you'll see this choice we're trying to get.
Oh, really? Oh, cool. I didn't know you did it, Drew. Thank you.
And then it says open, explore, search, merge.
Properties at the very bottom.
Properties.
Dun-dun-dun.
You guys are good. Mm. You know how to talk to
you. Jointly with four people, we kind of know what we're doing.
So in the
computer
section.
Okay, now we're up here. Now we're in general.
Yeah, and then look in the computer section. It'll show you, it'll say about the third line, how much RAM is in there.
Computer section. Or, computer name.
It says system, registered to, and then computer.
After general, it says computer name, and it says hardware, advanced, remote, and all that.
Well, Ray, I think we're going to have to go on.
Okay.
Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate
You're
it.
Welcome.
Good luck.
Have a nice day.
Take care. I think a 5-year-old computer could probably do for an upgrade or a new machine, actually.
It certainly wouldn't hurt anything.
Let's go ahead and take a call off air. Who wrote this? I guess from Santa Cruz?
Do we have a name?
Okay, from Santa Cruz. They Googled their own name. We don't know it. Found a lot of information about themselves. How do you get rid of that? And doesn't it seem to make identity theft easier? And it's from Angela in Santa Cruz.
Welcome to the new reality, Angela.
Googling's like the small part of it, actually.
Oh, yeah.
People sell this data, too.
You can go to... There's a couple of sites out there that will be extraordinarily impressive in terms of what they know about you just from simple public record searches. The addresses you've held, the phone numbers you've held, they're all out there.
So how do you protect yourself?
You don't. This is life. Unless you never want to use a computer or never want to register for anything, never want to buy anything or use a credit card.
What are some of the sites?
I had a bookmark here. I'll get back to you guys on Zaba Search. ZABA Search.com.
Zaba Search.
Yep.
Yeah, that's one that if you ever want to get paranoid about what the world knows about,
will light you up. Yep.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Okay, so
but remember that stuff is already out there. All Google is doing is making it and concentrated in one place.
Okay, so the question is, how do you actually protect your? I mean, the identity and like your name and where you live and all that stuff is probably going to be pretty public. But how do you make sure that somebody can't then therefore make a credit card with your name on it and start buying stuff and destroy your credit record? How does that stuff get protected?
There's some new legislation, and this affects the storage industry pretty significantly. That's come out in the last couple of years. Graham Leach Bliley is one of the biggest ones, which is a federal law. Came out in 99, and it requires the idea here is to protect your consumer information from financial institutions. If a bank, for example, when we've done some news stories about Citigroup losing tapes that have been lost in transit, then the bank is required to find out, to research everyone whose name could have been on that tape and send them written documentation about the potential of a loss.
Which
now,
is good.
The consumer then has to take steps to protect themselves.
What do they do?
If you're really paranoid about it, you cancel your credit cards, you change your checking account, change the bank, so that if anyone picked up that information and decoded it and used it wouldn't be accurate anymore.
Mm-hmm. So should we all be going through a cycle of every 6 months making sure our bank account gets changed, switching banks? And
it's like that caller we had earlier. How much pain do you want to go through over the paranoia?
Yeah.
But there are also other options, such as there are credit cards you can get that are one-time use credit card numbers, and you can contact your bank for more information on that, so that when you're making online transactions, it's made for online transactions, so that when you put in a number that can't be used any other time.
But see, I'm more concerned about you go up to this site like Zabasearch.com and you put in your name and you find out that, wow, your social security number's up there, your home address is up there.
Your social security number should not be up there. That's information that you don't want to get out.
But that social security number is not that hard to find because it's a public record, and as long as you find out where the person lives and how old they are, you can find it, right?
Think the social security numbers are public records.
You know what? It's time for us to get an expert on identity theft and how to protect yourself, because this is so frustrating. The data is out there. Now it's about making sure that nobody can use that against you.
Have any of you guys ever been a victim of identity theft? With all the internet usage?
No.
Have you had someone attempt?
Well, I have people try to fish me all the time.
Fishing is...
That's an attempt.
Okay, but I mean, have you been a victim?
That's how people get the information in the first
place. That's right.
Okay, but have you ever been a victim? Have you had an unidentified charge show up on your credit cards?
No.
Nobody
has?
I have not.
So, and do you check your credit card statements every month? At least run an eye over them?
Sure.
You guys do?
Miles? Most of the time.
Miles doesn't always pay his phone bill. No, he doesn't.
So I think a little bit of reasonable discipline in watching your financial situation will prevent a giant surprise down the road. But right, it doesn't prevent it from actually happening.
Okay, you know, Rick Philman, who's sitting by the phones waiting for calls, 476-2800.
Nice.
476-2800. He has had a $2,000 charge show up on his credit card.
And Rick, you'll have to answer on the instant messenger.
Or you could come in here and not take calls for a second, but yeah.
What'd you do? They took it off immediately. Okay.
Okay, that's good.
So he was watching it and prevented a problem. Yeah.
Make sure you know about it right away. That's a good thing to do.
I think, Lyle, your point about phishing is more, I'd be a lot more worried about phishing than I would about identity theft through the internet, somebody finding your address.
Absolutely. I think the best way for somebody to get your information is for you to give it to them.
Yeah, it's far more insidious.
Because you happen to know it. And
their sites are so good.
Yeah,
it's scary.
All right, from Bonnie Doon, Dave, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, Dave. Did I surprise you?
I'm here.
Okay, hi, Dave. How's Bonnie Doon doing today?
Oh, it's nice and sunny, a little cool.
Yeah? All right, so what's the problems up there?
Well, I heard your earlier comments about Tor, and I had tried installing Tor on a MacBook Pro, and I got everything working okay, except that it seemed to... slow the browsing down to a crawl. I timed a couple downloads, and it took maybe five times as long as it was taking over DSL without using the Tor. And on the website that I downloaded it from, they said that it shouldn't slow browsing down. So my question is, did I install something incorrectly, or is their claim that it won't slow things down wrong?
Well, I don't know enough about the Tor software to know what its cache is like.
Do you have
cache
Tor?
Is probably going to be the big deal there.
Where is Tor? Where do you put Tor? Is it on the memory stick?
No,
it's on your desktop.
I had it installed just on the hard disk.
Well, it's gonna. I mean, how new is your machine?
He has a MacBook Pro.
It's just a few months old.
But it's Intel.
No, I'm using the
Are you on dial-up or
no? It's DSL.
DSL. Okay.
And I was using it with Safari on the Mac part.
Yeah.
Right. And I think this is a cache-based item. But
you're also encrypting everything that you send and receive. Everything, including the
right.
Including the binaries.
Yeah, that'll totally do it.
Yeah.
So what's happening?
If you've got a pretty powerful processor, no problem.
Right. But you got a G4.
No. He has a MacBook Pro.
G4. No. Well, okay.
Yes, he has an Intel
processor. Let's clarify. How long ago did you buy the machine?
A couple months ago.
Okay.
Wow.
Intel. That should be fine. You shouldn't even notice that. Maybe
it depends upon the other site. Because, for example, with caching, it can make a huge difference. Because normally, if you don't have to request the image or the list of images on a site again, it's going to go very quickly. If the other end of the site, if the web server that you're connecting to...
In this case, the part of this whole ring.
Right.
Because it's that that's actually encrypting it.
Right. Is a little slow, then every single
time
you have to get every single
It's not just the encrypting. It's the handshaking with the servers all over the world.
Most of the handshaking done, I mean, if they switch it every few minutes, that's not going to be noticed. But if you take a file that's, 4K or something like that, and you have to have a machine that's a lot of people are hitting it once, and everybody has to have that file encrypted for it, that machine, that node that you're using, is going to slow down.
Yeah, but you're talking multiple nodes because there's going to be bounce traffic, increased distances.
Exactly. I mean all of that.
There's a lot going on here.
Yeah, so I think that probably makes
it may
sense.
Not be your computer. It may be the actual communication is slowed.
I think we're pretty clear it's not your computer. It's the communication line of the files.
So maybe their claim that it won't slow things down isn't right.
Well, I think it won't It won't slow your machine down, but it will slow your navigation of the site. Yeah.
In theory, it could go fast enough that you wouldn't notice the difference, but I could definitely see many cases where it would be a lot slower.
And because of this thing is trying to jump around every few minutes to be at a different node, that means that most likely your machine is going to point to different ones of these nodes, and some of them are going to be faster and slower. So as you do it, you could see it speed up and slow down.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's interesting.
But also, if this is becoming a very popular product and a lot more nodes aren't coming up, then you're going to see it slow down just in general.
Maybe you should just start keying up the sites that you visit most when you first enter, let's say, Firefox, you can actually choose to bookmark a number of sites in tabs, multiple tabs. And then when you click on that bookmark, it'll open up 10 tabs to your favorite news sites. And then you start reading one, and it's loading stuff in the background.
Yeah,
you don't have to wait.
Idea.
I mean, I do that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for the update on that, Dave. I really appreciate it. And the weather report on From Bonnie Doon.
Okay, thanks for your show.
Take care. And I bet if you have a slow internet connection, it's not really going to matter. It's going to be the same kind of... I mean, like if you got a slow internet connection... Because you're not passing that much more data.
An encryption?
Is it a lot more data? I don't think so.
I'm trying to think if my friend Alex will help me out here, I am, but adding encryption is going to add at least 20% overhead to your network communication.
From Live Oak, Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Oh, yeah, hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Right. I'm pretty naive about computers. I've had a PC for several years, and when something goes wrong, I have a real hard time with it, and I want to switch to a Mac and a laptop, probably buy myself a Christmas present or in that time of year.
Okay.
And I'm wondering when and where is a good time and place to get the best deal.
Okay. Well, I recommend people buying Apple products through student sales because I deal with a lot at the university and I see a lot of good prices going to students. So you can find a friend that works at a university, or
yeah, I can do that.
So that's a good starting point. Right off, you're going to get the cheaper of the prices that Apple releases. When to buy it? It's a tough one because Apple, you know, has a pretty standard rollout. Every once in a while, they produce a new product and it's better, and the prices are pretty. I mean, compared to their own prices, the prices are pretty much just small increments. If not, they stay the same, and the product gets a little bit better. But the prices are just more expensive than other machines. In any case, though, the longer you wait, the better the computer you'll get, and the cheaper it'll cost. So
now's the time to get a PC notebook.
There you go.
Get a Core 2. It'll be very fast, I guarantee it.
I think waiting till January would probably be a little bit better than waiting till December. But right now, the student prices are out, so right now's a good time, too.
Okay.
There you go. No answer at all.
Well, just as an aside, because I'm so naive, I listen to you guys, but mostly you're over my head.
Yeah, we lose each other, too. We don't know what we're talking about.
That's pretty funny. Okay, thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Jim.
And, you know, Christmas season, everyone's focused on Christmas season. So, you know, if it's not out now, it's definitely going to be out in time for Christmas buying season.
That's true. The Geeks This Morning... Drew Meyer, Miles Elam, that was Sean Cleveland. Answering the phone today was Rick Fillman. Thank you all for your participation on GeekSpeak.
Thank you, Lyle.
Hey, did you want to put a plug in for the new podcast featured on iTunes?
Hey, that's a good idea.
Well, it's not exactly new, but yes. If you download podcasts, please subscribe to GeekSpeak. Go to geekspeak.org and click on podcast. We'd like to get a little bit more people knowing about our show.
Yeah, leave a review. Let us know what you think.
Please do.
Cool.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used by our permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Thank you very much for listening to GeekSpeak. To those that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? Coming up next is Castle Cottage with Susan Freeman. She's picking out the music right now. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.